Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, live from the Bay, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. I have a very embarrassing confession to make. I had an extended dream about our podcast last night.
I'm actually afraid to go deeper into this, but what was the dream about?
Well, first of all, every time I have a dream that I actually remember, which is not regularly, I always try to pinpoint, like, where did that dream come from? And I think I can trace this one back to a comment you made when you were at my place last week, when you said that, like, the most pathetic thing in life is when two people are live podcasting together. I mean, it really drives home how lame you are in that moment.
Yeah, just how sad the entire enterprise is. Sure.
So I think this dream was the overcorrection to that, because our podcast was awesome, Andrew. Okay, so we were set up in a stadium, not unlike Oracle Arena. Okay, granted, the whole thing wasn't full, but there was a solid 10,000 people in there. We had like DJ booths. We were sort of dueling. Like, we were kind of like on opposite sides, almost.
Like a battle rap?
Yeah, sort of like that. It reminded me of like Kenny Smith's dunk contest show that he's been doing recently on TNT. I don't know if you've seen that, because similar to that show, all the crowd basically looked like a Coachella concert. I mean, they were just so lit, like so excited about every joke, like falling out of their seat, eyes glazing over, clearly probably had too many pills. So as the dream was unfolding, though, I had like an earpiece, right? And like they were feeding like crowd commentary into my headpiece, basically like giving me almost like lines to like throw at you. And as the show unfolded, they continually were just saying over and over, I kid you not, this was my real dream, role player, role player, role player. And this might have been sparked actually by like the 50 emails that we got from people who were really mad about your comments saying that Kevin Durant is only a role player on these Golden State Warriors from last podcast. So I guess we should start there. There's 10,000 people. There's 10,000 people in this stadium. Okay. They want it. They're screaming in my ear. They want to hear the answer. What is the answer to your previous statement about Kevin Durant being a role player?
I have a couple different responses to this. First of all, that wildly exceeded my expectations. You texted me this morning and said, I had a dream about the podcast. And I said, you have to talk about it on air. That is so much better. That was like a tricked out live stadium seating podcast.
Yeah, dude, we're big time in my mind.
Yeah, for real. And number two, if I ever catch myself dreaming about you lecturing me about DeMar DeRozan, I'm quitting the pod. So I don't think I've ever crossed over to Open Floor Dreams. Although I will say, any sort of dreams are probably better than what we got last night. So that's a good place to start. And yes, we did get a lot of pushback on my role player comments. So we could get to that too.
I do just want to put the role player thing into context here, because, I mean, it was a phenomenal game from a guy we never could have seen it coming from, Kevin Durant.
This is the encore to Kelly Olynyk in game 7.
Look, 38 points, 8 rebounds, 8 assists. Kevin Durant joined some other notable role players in putting up that line in the finals. They include LeBron James, Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, and Shaquille O'Neal. So just role player Hall of Famers right there.
God damn it. I was making a point, okay? The point is LeBron has to do everything for his team, whereas KD can kind of go off in certain games and sort of lay low in others. And it is still Steph's team. It still starts with him on offense, and it's all Draymond on defense. But you're right. I need to sort of take the L on this one. KD was unbelievable last night. And it's funny because, like, we got that email. I rarely respond to emails, but we got a long email taking me to task for my role player comments. And I responded doubling down. I'm not going to read my response. And then the dude, Chris from Utah, hit us back with another long response last night after the game. And I was like, you know, I could respond here, but this is like the worst possible hill to die on and the worst possible night to make this argument. So it's fine. KD is amazing. He was the best player on the floor last night. He is a superstar, and we're good. I will say this. I was right that because did you read the column I wrote yesterday?
Yes, I did. Which yeah. was good. It was your, like I said, in a text message to you, we made history at Sports Illustrated with you writing the 15th consecutive negative column about a single athlete. I mean, you really Dude. Went at KD from all angles. And I was also thinking, we were joking about how defensive he was in terms of responding to media criticism. And then I started to think, he's basically just responding to you. I'm not sure there's anybody else really out there who's taking these kinds of shots and angles at him.
No, no, I'm not going to let you pigeonhole me like this. I was perfectly fair to KD. The only time I've ever really vented was on that podcast a couple weeks ago. All I'm saying is that this series is not really that close with him involved. And with that, we should just jump into some of these questions. Because my one of my favorite emails of the playoffs was from Brett, who said last night, one line, Ben, you said this would be good.
Well, here's my thing on that. I also warned that I was concerned that there was going to be some one-sided games here. It didn't necessarily come with the three-point shooting, which was my concern, is that, you know, one team gets hotter than the other, the game goes small, and they just run the other team off the court, right? That's what I was worried about. What I wasn't expecting was Cleveland's very unique defensive strategy of only trying to guard three-pointers and just basically conceding dunks. I mean, I've never really seen a team sell out that hard to protect the line. And after the game, Ty Lue basically said they got their defense backwards, and then he didn't necessarily elaborate a ton on that.
Well, he didn't need to elaborate. I think we all saw it.
Yeah, it was dunk parade. So there's going to have to be some adjustment there. But I think the scary part, if you're Cleveland, right, Golden State has counters on counters. What I was really impressed with Golden State, it was a couple, you know, minutes to get up to speed. I think both teams were kind of feeling each other out early in the first quarter. But there was not this slow build-up or like this kind of fooling around that we've seen from Golden State at other times early in series, most notably game one against San Antonio. I mean, those guys got up to speed very quickly, and they recognized what Cleveland was trying to do defensively in terms of taking away the three-point line. And instead of kind of floundering out there on the arc, how do we get the ball to Steph? How do we get the ball to Clay? Let's run them off 15 more screens that don't work. Let's, you know, just start settling for 30-footers because, you know, on a good day, those guys can hit those shots. They did exactly what you're supposed to do, which is cut hard to the basket, look for the cutters, incorporate the big men as passers, and keep the ball moving. It was beautiful. And I understand the frustration of, okay, well, like the emailer said, you know, this wasn't a competitive game for very long. I mean, it was pretty much done, I'd say, midway through the third quarter. You know, Cleveland's hopes were kind of extinguished. The Warriors played some pretty beautiful basketball, actually on both ends, but on offense, to go 20 assists and one turnover in the first half of a finals game is remarkable, and I enjoyed that.
Yeah, I'm with you, actually. Defensively, there were a couple plays in that second quarter that Draymond made that were just out of this world, and he also had two fouls at the time. Like, he was playing that entire second quarter with two fouls, and there were just a couple plays that only he could make, and it just perfect timing, incredible hands, and stuff like that is part of the appeal with the Warriors. Like, you watch their games and you're like, man, these dudes are incredible. And offensively, I mean, yeah, it felt like the game, the first quarter was the version of this series that I think a lot of people were talking themselves into, where tensions are high, everyone's tight, and it just sort of turns into this kind of ugly iso ball contest, in which case, you know, LeBron is the best weapon and Kyrie is pretty dangerous as well, and the Cavs can really hang with them. And then that second quarter, the Warriors started to get out in transition, and it was just over. I mean, and like, you could see it starting to happen, and it actually started with the Warriors second unit in there. And then when KD and Steph came back, there was just nothing they could do. And I will say this. So obviously, a lot of people listening probably didn't even stay up for the fourth quarter. And I understand why people are going to kind of complain about the state of the finals, if, especially if they continue this way. But for me, it was cathartic to watch that happen because we've obviously been, we've been doing all these previews, we've been going on the radio, and all these different people all week have been like, well, like I like the Warriors in six and it could go seven. Like the Cavs are going to really make this tougher than it looks. And like, and so I felt like I was going crazy as the week unfolded and I started hearing all these different people talk me into the Cavs. I was like, what am I missing? Is this like, have I been looking at this all wrong? And then those last three quarters last night, I felt pretty validated.
Well, I would say it's even worse here in the Bay Area because, first of all, Warriors fans are everywhere. I mean, this whole region is Warriors fans. And guess what? They were a little scarred by last year's finals. You might have heard. You might have heard that that didn't go quite well for them. So the people who are really talking up the Cavaliers over the last week, to me at least, were Warriors fans who were very cautious and paranoid and trying to set their expectations. In the building, and I was sitting next to Lee Jenkins last night, his comment was, early in the first quarter, it still felt a little bit like game seven in terms of the crowd tension and just like everybody being just like petrified by the presence of LeBron, especially because he started so well. And also Kyrie had some amazing finishes and it was like, oh no, they like still haven't figured these guys out. The pressure was released, you know, by the second, you know, midway through that second quarter, like you're saying, the transition dunks when KD is just sledgehammering dunk after dunk. And, you know, it's pretty clear that they just don't have the defensive energy to kind of slow him down or deal with him.
There were seriously stretches of that second quarter where it looked like the NBA All-Star game. Like, you know how guys just kind of clear out and try to avoid injury? Like, that was KD in the second quarter.
Oh, there was a number of business decisions being made. You know?
Yeah, like Katie probably could have thrown it off the backboard on a couple of those dunks.
Oh, no doubt. And this is one thing I really want to hone in on about game one, because throughout the pre-finals run-up, like you're mentioning, these radio interviews and all the talk that we do, there's always so much focus on how, and this is not just a this year thing, this is the last 7 years, how does the opposition defend LeBron James? That's always like the central question that we always talk about, right? Like, who's going to stay on him? Do you dare him to shoot? You know, do you send help? Do you leave the shooters? That's always a question we focus on. This year, I think we kind of blew it. I think we maybe should have spent about 10 times more time than we actually did spend talking about how Cleveland's going to defend Kevin Durant, because the only guy they have who's really a good defensive matchup for Durant is LeBron. We know LeBron's got to play 40-plus minutes running the offense, doing everything for Cleveland like he has these, you know, last three finals, right? We know that Durant is super long. He can get to his shot in lots of places. I mean, that's an issue for LeBron. It's an issue for everybody. Past LeBron, their best chance is what? Probably Richard Jefferson?
But by the way, though, the answer was LeBron. All along, everyone said LeBron is going to have to guard KD. And like you were saying, LeBron has traditionally thrived in that role. You know, like he has locked KD down in the past. And that was always kind of that was the factor coming in where we were like, well, maybe that can continue. Yeah. And The Warriors run way too many sets to get him clean looks. That wasn't true in Oklahoma City when LeBron did own KD. And also LeBron, I think at this point in his career, like he hasn't been the guy who plays both ways for 40 plus minutes in a couple years. And like reputationally, he is still, you know, one of the most complete players we've ever seen, but like, he just that has not been his role in Cleveland.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And it's not just the LeBron on KD sort of at the ball factor. It's also Cleveland's personnel is not made of these traditional rim protectors. You know, these guys who are going to be able to challenge Kevin Durant above the rim. There's not really a Rudy Gobert out there, right? Yeah. So you see their lack of size with guys like Kevin Love and Tristan Thompson kind of coming over when they're trying to help. Like, how much help are they really providing here? And I think that's a question. And then also when you look at Cleveland's bench personnel, like I said, I mean, Richard Jefferson's sort of the best option to kind of throw out there. Everything else their bench is doing really is offense oriented. they don't have another sort of designated center option to kind of shore up the back line. I mean, Channing Frye is not that guy at all. And they don't really have a designated like wing defender with the necessary length to go after KD. I mean, you've got guys like Shumpert or J.R. Smith, but that's a really tough ask there in terms of like those guys playing longer or bigger or just trying to harass KD. I mean, it's just not really going to work, right? So this is my problem going forward in the series to kind of boil this all together is like, what is your adjustment on KD? Do you just say, hey, LeBron, like you have to guard him for basically like, you can't switch, right?
Well, yeah. And I think that's all you can say. And there's a little bit of hope there. I think if the solution is LeBron, you have to be incredible. At least he's someone that you know can do that. Like LeBron really can kind of blow your mind a little bit. And maybe that can work for one or two games. But to your point, I mean, I don't see that happening for four games.
Yeah, see, as you mentioned, we were all assuming that LeBron was going to kind of hold KD in check, right?
Yeah.
And if that didn't happen, then we were assuming that Steph was going to kind of hold him in check. You know, at least you were. You know, like Steph was going to be the focal point of the offense, so KD's role wasn't going to be as big. What Golden State did, I thought, was really smart. It was sort of like an improved version of what they did to open the regular season, which was like get KD comfortable, get him going, and turn him loose. And it worked to major effect in game one. And now Cleveland's going to be back on its heels trying to figure things out. You know, we always get this question from people for what, the last year and a half in terms of like, if you could pick one player and add them to this team, like, who would you pick to like make a finals champion, right? Mm-hmm. This is what we learned in game one, that Kevin Durant to the Warriors was the answer to that question, period, right? Like he is the guy who exploits
for either team.
Yeah, he's the guy who exploits Cleveland's weaknesses in terms of perimeter defenders, you know, not a lot of depth there. And he's the guy who has the length and the tenacity. And when he's playing assertively and confidently, he can expose their help defensive issues in terms of protecting the basket. And that's the last thing in terms of LeBron's defense is the more time he spends guarding Durant going forward in the series, the less time he's there to help in other situations as a backline defender. And when they go smaller, they really need him helping. And that's going to be a problem too, because otherwise you're asking guys like Love to, you know, come across and, you know, defend against a Steph Curry drive or defend against those quick passes and attacks from the weak side.
I think that's the issue with LeBron's defense. Like, I don't mean to say that he's not a super valuable defender, but he's not the guy, like, he's not Kawhi Leonard. His role, he's best as sort of a free safety who can pick his spots to help and make the whole defense tougher because of it. And he's not going to be able to do that in this series. So it hurts them in a couple different ways because he's not the guy that can lock down KD for 40 minutes either. A couple other general thoughts before we move into some more specific questions. Tristan Thompson, just an absolute zero last night. And I don't know what, I mean, he was the one reason, like, of all the ways that people have found to talk themselves into the Cavs this series, like Tristan Thompson was the one point that I couldn't really refute because he's the guy who has always given Golden State problems. And I mean, he was just a non-factor. The other thing I would say is you mentioned the depth. If you take a couple steps back, not only did the Warriors have four superstars to 2.5 for Cleveland, but they also are somehow deeper. So it just, the Cavs are in trouble, man. It's not looking great because somehow the Warriors have sort of beaten the system on a couple different levels here. And the Cavs, like you said, like there's 1.5 useful guys coming off the bench for them. And that's an issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're Golden State, you're thrilled that Thompson only had 3 offensive rebounds. He goes scoreless. J.R. Smith was basically a non-factor. I mean, another guy I talk about, you know, being invisible. You know, he's right there with Tristan Thompson to me. And you're never going to beat Golden State if you're trying to go 3 offensive options in your starting lineup versus their 5. I mean, that's just never going to work. Then you go to their bench. I mean, I was concerned, and I said this entering the series, I was a little bit worried about how guys like Korver, Deron Williams were going to hold up. Mm-hmm. I did not expect them to each basically, they played a combined 39 minutes, went 0 for 7, didn't score. I mean, that's a lot of dead. Like, that's a lot of dead minutes. And, you know, Golden State's style is they're always going to get something from their bench. You don't totally know who it's going to be. It might not be a 15-point outburst, right? But those guys are going to continue moving the ball. They're going to be able to play with at least one or two of their core four stars. They're going to get production from that second unit. You can't just have these dead, lifeless corpses out there filling these minutes.
Dude, to be completely honest with you, one of the craziest stretches of NBA history were the last 2.5 months when people truly believed that Deron Williams was going to be a factor in the Cavs-Warriors series. And Korver, I understand it a little more because he's a guy who can really exploit all the open looks that LeBron's going to create. But like, I remember they signed Deron Williams, and there were like real stories, real discussion topics on ESPN. People asking like, does this sort of tip the scales with Cavs Warriors? Like, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Anytime Deron Williams is out there, it's an issue for Cleveland.
Well, look, we know what that illustrates, and so do our Australian listeners. It's the depth of the Delhi void, okay?
It's true. It's the one factor that everyone forgot to consider.
Real quick on Cleveland's offense, because we did spend a lot of time kind of breaking down their defense, and clearly there was offensive issues. All these guys no-showing. Why aren't they able to get going? LeBron's got a whole bunch of turnovers. People are kind of fixating on that.
Uh-huh.
What's the fastest you've ever driven a car? And I don't, you know, don't self-incriminate.
I don't think I've cracked triple digits. I'm going to say somewhere in the 90s. God.
Well, you're clearly from the East Coast. Us West Coasters have a lot more open roads. Let's just say you can push it past 100 fairly easily. But there is a moment as you're kind of watching that odometer go up where it's not fun anymore, and like it starts to be a little scary, you know, like, oh God, I've bitten off more than I can chew.
Well, yeah, depending on how crappy your car is, if once you hit like 80s or 90s, the car starts to shake a little bit, and you realize it's not designed for that kind of movement. And Andrew, maybe that's where the Cavs are.
You're ruining the illusion that we both have like high performance sports cars here with this analogy. Look, man, we got this Mack Weldon money. We're out here in matching Ferraris. We have no problem going 125 on the freeway. But anyway, the point of this was LeBron was cruising like 85 left lane, no problem for the entire Eastern Conference playoffs in terms of dicing up opposing defenses, just complete control, a step ahead. I mean, we compared it to telepathy. What we saw was a huge adjustment period where now all of a sudden he's going like 110 through traffic, slamming on the brakes, fishtailing, because Golden State's defensive energy was that good. Their speed was that good. They were just in places off the ball where LeBron was not expecting them to be. You saw it with deflections. You saw it with steals. They were able to collapse and recover. One possession that stood out to me when Cleveland dumped the ball into Tristan Thompson on the block, and he had three guys on him before he had even completed his catch. And yet, once he kind of passes the ball back out, Golden State's defenders are back and locked in place. And so all this talk about, okay, how does Cleveland slow down Kevin Durant? I mean, that's one half of it. The other half is like, how does Cleveland pick up its pace and adjust to this level of defense so that they can get some of these role guys who are totally complementary players who need to be set up for their offense kind of free and going? If Golden State continues to play defense at this level, they're going to win the title, period.
Yeah. Well, and that was the third factor that I had actually forgotten about that I meant to mention is I think another useful way to look at this matchup and why it's such a difficult series for Cleveland is that they have one guy who can maybe guard Durant, whereas the Warriors can throw a couple different people at LeBron and have them be effective, whether it's like Draymond can take him for 6 to 8 minutes. Durant, Iguodala bothered him. And Iggy actually looked healthier last night than he had for the previous like month or so. So, I mean, it's tough. It's tough. I guess we can go big picture here real quick before we get into some of the questions. What was your pick going in? Was it Warriors in five?
Warriors in five. Thanks for reading. I appreciate that.
do you stick with that now?
I will say that I experienced the same thing you did, which is wavering a little bit coming into the series because so many people were talking 6-7 or Cavs win.
Yeah.
I'm feeling pretty comfortable with 5. I don't want to start like everyone saying sweep talk because that's where the deja vu really kicks in from last year where we came out of that game 2 blowout and it was like Cleveland's done, stick a fork in them.
Yeah.
But there are just a lot of fundamental critical problems here for Cleveland to address. And you just wonder how many of them can they address if they can only go 8 players deep? You know, that's sort of my issue. One more thing that you mentioned in terms of like Cleveland's personnel options on KD, I have the same feeling or the same concern about their personnel options on Steph. I thought Steph
was totally
so much quicker, more decisive, more comfortable, more confident shooting throughout game 1 than he did at the end of last year's finals. He looked not unguardable, but pretty close to it. And what are your adjustments for him? Like Darren Williams, you know, I mean, what are you going to do?
Yeah, well, that to me, we're 25 minutes into the podcast and this is our first mention of Steph Curry. And that's one of the things that bumps me out about Durant being there, because he was awesome last night. It was a great way to respond to kind of the second half of last year's finals. And it sort of feels like he's a footnote here, but he basically played a perfect game. And yes, that's another reason that the Cavs are completely screwed. But it's also a reason that this is all kind of bittersweet to me. And I think that is, honest to God, the root of my Warriors frustration, is that I am a Steph Curry believer in a world full of Steph Curry skeptics. And I'm kind of pissed off that he's not going to get the credit that he deserves for this series.
Well, don't rush to that necessarily, because if Cleveland does panic here and they just decide like, look, we got to start throwing more at Durant, otherwise he's going to kill us.
Yeah,
that does set up for like the roundhouse Steph Curry, you know.
That's performance. True. That's true. And Clay is still lurking out there, man. He's kind of like wandering the wilderness here, but he is the one guy who could really just end this series. And if they sweep, it'll be because Clay Thompson comes alive and they just become a whole new level of impossible.
You made a point the other day about how the Warriors are bad at being the villains. I think you mostly focused on Steph and KD, I believe.
Right.
Klay is also bad at being a villain. It struck me during game 1 because he is the quintessential guy who got basically demoted within the pecking order. So he's not getting as many shots. He's struggling because of it. He can't get his rhythm. It doesn't really matter. And yet, instead of checking out and demanding a trade and really fueling like the backlash vibe, he's going out there and playing really hard defense every single possession, locking up all sorts of different guys. I mean, his stands against Kevin Love were remarkable. Such good discipline as a post defender against a bigger guy. He shadowed, I believe it was J.R. Smith, across the paint. Again, no foul, just hounding his dribble from the left wing to the right wing. Had a couple of nice moments against LeBron James as well.
Yeah. Like,
Klay did not get the memo that he's supposed to be a disgruntled superstar who wants more touches and he's worried about his next contract. Like, that memo just didn't get through to Klay's email.
That's true. Although let me push back on one point. He is of the Warriors. KD's not a very good villain because he is not convincing because he went to the Warriors, number one. That's an automatic hit to his street cred. And also, he's so clearly insecure about all the criticism. Steph, too good a guy. I'm a big Steph Curry is actually cool guy, but he's too nice to be a convincing villain. Klay has actually had some great moments over the past few years. I mean, he kind of turned the finals last year when he called out LeBron. He also has been incredibly dismissive of the Clippers every step of the way, and just generally like doesn't seem to care about anyone else. And I think that it sort of helps his cause here. So if the Warriors are ever going to be good villains, they're going to really need to lean on Klay and Draymond.
We need the It's a Man's World Klay to show up here to
exactly
exactly kind of fuel some fire here. Yeah, no, I hear you on that, but it's just one more thing where when people complain about this series, and I understand why they will, I'm always in that camp of like, okay, but let's also appreciate the greatness factor, right? And this is one of those things that Popovich would look at and say, this is an all-star who made his name as one of the greatest shooters in NBA history, who just inexplicably lost his shot. And yet at the same time, he hasn't taken them out of their team offense. He hasn't necessarily forced it like crazy, although he did take some, you know, pretty rough shots in game one. But he's also maintained his defensive attitude and energy throughout the struggles. That's what you want from a championship team. That's impressive to me. That's a reason to watch.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I really did enjoy that game last night. It was wild to see just how much better Golden State was, because also it was a 20-point game, but spiritually it was really more of a 30-point game. I mean, there were long stretches in that second half where the Warriors were pretty openly screwing around. And it was wild, man.
You know who had the worst night last night, honestly, besides the Cavaliers? I would say Harrison Barnes.
yeah.
Right when Durant signed, I had a line, something along the lines of, you know, going from Harrison Barnes to Kevin Durant's like going from a tricycle to a Ferrari. And all of the things that Barnes couldn't do offensively that just frustrated the living daylights out of Warriors fans last year, and I just basketball observers in general, in terms of being so limited in that corner shooting role, not really being comfortable attacking off the dribble, not attacking in transition, you know, not being the greatest ball handler, you know, bogging down and sort of post-ups as sort of like his only mode of offense at times. It's like all that stuff is just completely wiped off the map with Durant when you've got him just tearing off down the court and scaring people, you know, when he's, you know, beelining to the rim, you know, pulling up with those crazy, you know, behind the back, shoulder shaking, mid-range jumpers, just the viciousness to a lot of what KD was doing. There was a decent amount of punishment from Durant to the Cavaliers.
It's true. It's true. Look, KD is the car that does not shake when you go above 100 miles an hour. Like, he is really doing his thing, and there's just nothing that the Cavs can do to answer it.
I didn't necessarily expect it. You know, maybe I was trying to manage my expectations, or maybe just kind of the doubt factor was creeping in. I thought he was going to be nervous in game one.
What I expected was what we saw in the first quarter. I mean, because I basically had to do a couple different interviews yesterday and was like, yeah, this is not going to be a close series. And after I hung up, I started to realize like game one will be tight because everyone's just going to be too turned up. And it's just going to be kind of ugly, and it's going to look like a closer series than it really is. And it lasted for 12 minutes. It was really dramatic for exactly 12 minutes.
Yeah, for sure. And I still thought, though, by halftime that they had 60, the Warriors did, and it could have been 75.
Yeah,
I mean, all those missed layups. They weren't really shooting well from three. They were generating so many open looks and missing a bunch of them. That has me a little nervous as we go forward in this series. I mean, definitely we can agree Cleveland can play better across the board. They're going to get more from Thompson. Their bench can't be any worse. Kevin Love can probably do a little bit more. Kyrie had some success. That should continue. LeBron can always step it up as a series unfolds. I mean, that's sort of been his MO his entire career. But the gap here was wide in game one. And as Kevin Durant himself said, the Warriors can play better than they showed in game one. And I firmly believe that. I mean, as great as they were offensively in terms of their execution, they can be better. There's no doubt.
You know what? It constantly annoys me whenever, because LeBron did this a couple times, like after 30-point wins in the playoffs, he would come out and be like, well, you know, like, We can sharpen up before the next game. Like, that wasn't quite good enough tonight. I hate when players say that. But yes, it's true that technically the Warriors can be better than they were last night.
Well, we should start coming on. We should count our 5-star reviews on iTunes. So, like, you know, let's say we have a good show. We get like 18 of them. We should come on the next episode and be like, yeah, you know, we got 18 5-stars, but we could do better than that.
We can do better. We can always do better. All right. We need to move on. We've talked enough about that blowout. Very quickly, though, since we don't have an ad, can you tell the people about your event on Saturday night in the Bay Area?
Oh, man, I'm not good at plugs. You're kind of putting me on the spot. It's at a place called Dunk Contest. I think it's like a Warriors store. Basically, it's a Warriors World event. If you guys don't know about Warriors World, you're under a rock. hilarious blog. Sheed runs
it. I really, really like Warriors World. And the two guys that you're with, Sam Esfandiari and Andy Liu, those guys are two of the best follows on NBA Twitter.
Yeah, their whole squad is just funny, and they get it. So it's like a live show. I don't know. It's like a panel, maybe. I don't know if we're podcasting exactly. This really sounds nerdy. I promise you it'll probably be better than I'm making it sound. I'm not the world's best pitch man. But Saturday night before game two at Dunk Contest, I think it's in Burlingame, which is, you know, pretty close to San Francisco. So check it out.
Yeah, I am really jealous. I'm honestly not that jealous that you're at the finals. I prefer my trip to LA last week versus watching these blowouts. But I'm really jealous that you're going to be in the mix on Saturday night. I'm sure that'll be a lot of fun. And I look forward to hearing a recap next week. And I'm curious as to how many listeners we have out there and whether people are going to come up to you and ask you to explain my bullshit Kevin Durant role player take.
I get your flack constantly. I'm always kind of the drive-by shooting victim on some of the things that you say. And what I like to tell people is this. Andrew, you're kind of a greased pig when it comes to your opinions. Like, you're not one of these guys who just gets set in his ways and just sticks to it. I mean, like, you're a little loosey-goosey in terms of your takes.
No. Excuse me. I'm not loosey-goosey. I could just admit when I'm wrong. Okay?
That's the same thing to me. Okay.
All right. Like,
I stick my foot down and, you know, I ride it to the end. And if I'm wrong, I have to be like overwhelmingly proven that I'm wrong. You, on the other hand, you can spend a month trashing KD and then halfway through the second quarter of game one be like, well, okay, I'm done with that.
Yeah, all right. Let's talk. Two more questions on KD here. Speaking of which, Roman says, should that role player soundbite be played every time Sharp makes a prediction going forward? Look, I was right about this series. I may have sort of overstated KD's role or understated it, I guess, but I was right about the series. So I'm taking credit for that. I'm not even calling it a bad prediction. It's just a question of semantics as far as the role player stuff is concerned. Mobeen asks, who had the greatest role player performance in NBA history? Ori, Iguodala, Kawhi? And if Golden State wins, does Kevin Durant take that crown?
Oh, boy. Well, yeah, he's right up there with other great role players, like we said, LeBron and MJ. Well, we had another question about, like, who our favorite role players were,
yeah,
as opposed to, like, the greatest role player performances. I mean, Ori, in terms of performance, definitely got to be in that mix. But I was thinking about this. The key to a good role player is usually a haircut or an accessory. Like, that is really, that's really, or it could be a body image thing, like Boris Diaw. I mean, definitely his chunkiness is like putting him over the top. Like, if Boris Diaw was fit, he wouldn't be nearly as fun as he was like in the 2014 finals, although he did slim down for that year, famously so. But I, you know, when I think role players, I'm thinking Horace Grant, Meta World Peace.
That's a good one.
A guy like Norris Cole, a real throwback for the Blazers fans from the early 90s, Robert Pack. And then really all of Michael Jordan's centers were pretty amazing in their own way. I mean, Luke Longley, Bill Wennington, remember Bill Cartwright, just the herky jerk? These guys weren't necessarily great, but they're very memorable role players. Those are the kinds of guys that I think of, whether it's goggles, whether it's, you know, funny things shaved into your head, whether it's the high top fade, whether it's, you know, 25 extra pounds in Diaw's case. Whether it's being a redhead like Longley, that's where I go when I think role players. I honestly don't, and this is very, very rare for me because I don't go to the X's and O's or like the big game winning shots. I go to the weirdness.
Yeah, I'm with you. So the question that you mentioned is from Mark, and he listed his favorite role players of all time, which is Robert Ori, Jason Terry, Sam Cassell, Ron Harper, Vinnie Johnson. He was not counting Manu or Iguodala, which I think is probably appropriate. And of course, Bill Walton. And you listed some really good ones. The Robert Pack one is a super deep cut. I don't know. I had forgotten about Boris Diaw, but he might be my favorite one because he was legitimately guarding LeBron through half of that series. And that was amazing. I don't think I've ever seen anything that was more inexplicable in the NBA Finals than Boris Diaw doing like a pretty decent job on LeBron for the Spurs. And beyond that, though, I had a couple. Would you count Rasheed Wallace on the Pistons as a role player? Probably not.
There's a case for it. Like, that was kind of the team that was famous for all being role players, sort of, you know? It's like, we're all stars in our role. Like,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he's probably too good. But, I mean, Sheed's title was one of my favorite things through the 2000s.
Well, see, Ben Wallace is the one there, though, because headband and fro, you know, and like and defensive, like specific role. I mean, obviously, he was an incredible defender. It's probably insulting to call him a role player as well. But that's where I go when I think that team and role player.
Yeah. Yeah. He's too good, though. He's too good. So my two role players, Stephon Marbury on the Celtics and Eddie House on the Celtics. They were just a fantastic tandem at the end of that bench. Maybe they weren't. Were they on the same team? Which I probably should have looked this up. But
they might have been different teams, but yeah. Yes.
Either Marbury, way, those are two all-timers for me.
Yeah, Marbury did a great job filling that Tracy McGrady for the Spurs role.
Yeah, exactly. and honestly, it would be great if a different team would bring him back every single spring. But my all-time favorite.
He's definitely available. There's no question.
Yeah. My all-time favorite, though, is Jason Terry on the Mavericks because he just, like, especially for this morning, I was writing about game ones and the way we often overreact and the series winds up flipping entirely 10 days later. And that happened in that Mavericks series. And it's almost entirely due to Jason Terry kind of blowing up in that game two in that fourth quarter after Wade taunted him. And then Jet comes back doing his airplane dance up and down the court in Miami. I mean, still to this day, I don't think I'll ever love a finals more than I loved Jason Terry and Dirk in that year.
Well, that one was a role player extravaganza. I mean, in addition to Jason Terry, who fits my criteria because of the headband.
Yeah, perfectly.
And the celebration. You've also got the 5'2" J.J. Barea out there. I mean, he's a role player extraordinaire by himself. And let's not forget DeSean Stevenson.
Oh, my God. Yes, yes.
Was maybe the peak LeBron troll in NBA history. I mean, I'm not sure anybody... Well, okay, granted, it lasted about... He had three solid weeks, right, where he was just living on top of the world with his T-shirt.
Yeah, Jason Gallagher from The Ringer suggested recently that the Mavericks should retire DeSean Stevenson's How My Dirk Taste T-shirt in their rafters.
Well, I'm sure he'd be ready to go to that celebration, there's no doubt.
It was quite a time.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So this is what makes role players great. So I guess my message, though, to guys like Pat McCaw, Ian Clark, you know, these guys who have this potential to kind of be breakthrough role players here these next few years, do something different, you know, get some crazy socks, you know, go Jason Terry with the socks, get a nutty headband, you know, do something crazy with your hair. Like, really become this indelible guy. So we're talking about you 5 to 10 years from now. You're on the stage. Make use of your opportunity.
It's a great note. It's a great takeaway from game one. It's Pat McCaw needs to step his game up. Next question, though, from The Wiz. The Cavs can add any player from any non-playoff team for the remainder of the finals. Who do they take? So it has to be a team outside the playoffs. Otherwise, the easy answer would be Kawhi.
Yeah, they definitely need Kawhi, maybe two of them.
a couple different Kawhis.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, who is the best perimeter? Like, right now, to me, the critical mismatch is Durant. They just have to have somebody they can throw on Durant, save LeBron for the help defender. So I guess my answer is whichever the best perimeter defender who wasn't on a playoff team was.
So let me ask you, though. Would Anthony Davis qualify?
No, I mean, I think Durant's too quick. We saw that actually with Love and Thompson, and just the lateral quickness is too much to ask for anybody who's a big. I don't think that he can stay with Durant in space. Durant's handle is too good. That's a tough one.
Yeah. So basically, there's no hope, even with this fake alternate reality. Great. It's good segue to our next question. Jim from Seattle. If the Warriors win the next three titles, all over the Cavs, and Durant is Finals MVP in all three, what's the storyline of the 2020 NBA Finals between Cleveland and Golden State? First team since Russell Celtics to win four in a row? Greatest player of all time, LeBron or Durant or Jordan? LeBron's 10th straight Finals? And who would be least happy in this scenario? LeBron, Curry, Westbrook, or Adam Silver?
I mean, this is a huge ask from Jim. Like, we're trying to forecast his imaginary universe 3 years into advance. Can I just simplify this down and ask you a question? Because we got into that LeBron versus Jordan thing, and you made the statement, another one which I rigorously disagreed with, which was that LeBron's automatically better than Jordan if he beats this Warriors team. Let me ask you this. Is Jordan automatically better than LeBron if LeBron gets swept here? Can LeBron be the greatest player of all time if he gets swept multiple times in the finals during his career? Is that possible?
Yeah, absolutely it's possible. If LeBron got swept here and then came back and beat this team next year, he would be in the conversation all over again. I think it's appropriate that Jordan is going to go down as the best ever and LeBron will be number two, because I do think that there's just a little bit of separation there, and this is probably the right answer. But I just, all I was saying is that I reserve the right to throw all of this shit out the window if LeBron wins and he's not going to, so it's fine. It's a moot point, but I don't think that you should account for sweeps here, because look, this Warriors team is so much better than any team that Jordan played in the finals. Like, they are several levels up from what Jordan was dealing with, and that has to be factored in.
Okay, that was a pretty good answer. I'll take that one. I'm not even going to fight you on that one. In terms of, like, flash forwarding to 2020, one funny thing that I took away from the game last night was one or two members of the Boston media were in attendance already plotting what the 2019 finals was going to be like when they were hosting it. So nice. I don't know.
Way to stay on brand, Celtics fans.
For sure. But maybe that they're feeling that there's some vulnerability there with this rotation with Cleveland, right? I mean, their core stars are obviously intact, you know, pretty well. But when you see so many of the supporting guys looking old, kind of looking slow, struggling to keep up, at times with Golden State's athleticism, you know, maybe if you're a boss and you're seeing yourself as this up and coming team, it is possible to envision 2 years down the road where Cleveland's having those same kinds of problems with a team like Boston. I don't know. Or maybe they're just dreaming. You tell me.
Yeah. I think it's that's the reason I wouldn't worry too much about the answer to this question, is I think one way or another, things will shift much quicker than we realize with these two teams. I mean, the Warriors, especially now that Durant is talking about taking less money so that they'll have more flexibility with guys like Iggy and Sean Livingston. Like, the Warriors are set up for a nice little run here, but the Cavs, who knows what'll happen? You know, this could go a lot of different ways. The Celtics will very much be in the mix, as much as we like to make fun of them. And the one thing that I found most, to answer this question, this is not going to happen. I think at most we'd have one more rematch next year, but I wouldn't even necessarily bet on that, because who knows what Boston will do this summer, and who knows what the Washington Wizards will do this summer. You know, bring Boogie in, let's see what happens. But my overriding reaction to this was the Silver part of it. Although the Westbrook part is pretty good too. Did you see he was watching Sister Act 2 during the finals last night?
I did, yeah.
It was a pretty solid move from him.
Yeah. Trying to take the lowest road possible while also being funny.
I can't blame him, all right? Like, if I didn't have to work and write about these games, I would probably watch some movies too. But
yeah, he's probably got the cupcake Instagrams queued up for the finals MVP presentation.
Oh yeah, that would actually be pretty great. The number one question, though, from this, like, when is Silver going to start taking some heat from this? Because one of the things I saw a tweet last night saying David Stern blocked CP3 to the Lakers. Adam Silver let Durant go to the Warriors. Look what happened. And I understand that is oversimplified, but David Stern is already kind of unfairly underappreciated in terms of what he did over like 25 years. I feel like you read Twitter and people are just crapping on David Stern whenever his name gets brought up. And it's kind of unfair. And say what you will about David Stern, he would have found a way to get that cap smooth to avoid what happened. He wouldn't have.
He would have had the butter knife out in the kitchen, smoothing it himself.
Exactly. You know, Silver could not have stepped in to block Durant to Golden State, but David Stern would have smoothed the cap and forced the union to make a deal, and Silver didn't. And now we're here for the next 2 or 3 years.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Silver. I don't want to dwell on this issue because I did declare a moratorium on all complaints about competitive balance on the last podcast. I'm going to stick to it. Two things jumped out from Silver's press conference, which always takes place before game one. The first was unrelated to any of this. It was his response about moving the game, the All-Star game, to Charlotte and bringing it back. He did not seem to believe what he was saying in terms of how much movement the state legislature had made in terms of changing their law. It didn't seem like his heart was in it. He really struggled with the answer to the question that was sort of posed to him, which is like, you know, why did you feel like you could put the game back? So that was just, to me, it was kind of a unique moment, very anti-Stern-like. I mean, Stern would never, I think, look so vulnerable. That was one side. The other thing was, I thought his take on the competitive balance issue was really unfulfilling. I mean, his takeaway, and I'm going to quote this, his takeaway was that the Warriors are inspiring people, inspiring children to play basketball because they're so good. And then he goes...
He really said that?
Yeah, that's what he said. And then he goes, I also think these things have a way of working themselves out. And I just wonder, that is such a passive take. And are the Warriors really going to work themselves out? Or is KD going to give back a few million dollars? Are they going to keep Andre Iguodala? Are they going to re-sign Draymond Green when he comes up? Are they going to max out Steph Curry? 2 years from now, they're going to be able to max out Kevin Durant. And they're just going to go forward. I mean, how does this just work itself out? Barring some crazy injury, I don't know how that happens.
Yeah, I mean, I understand what he's saying to some degree there, because it's a similar point to what I just said, in terms of like, it's going to change in ways that we can't, that aren't totally clear now, but will significantly alter the landscape over the next year or two. And not necessarily with Golden State, but I mean, like, look, the league has had dynasties before and survived just fine. So it doesn't have to be a crisis. So I get his point there, but it's just interesting, man. He took great pride in negotiating the CBA before the deadline. Remember that?
Oh, of course. And
so that was like a real point of emphasis for him, was like, we are going to have labor peace and this is going to be a big victory. David Stern, again, would not have gone that direction. And it's kind of interesting to look at it, because we talked about the CBA issues last week, and had they waited, maybe more of these problems would have become clear. And yes, maybe there would have been like a massive work stoppage over the summer, which isn't ideal. But at the same time, like, certainly the NBA would have had a lot more leverage in any CBA talks. And it just... who knows whether they might have come up with a system that levels the playing field a little bit more.
Yeah, well, sort of like I said, this was the last year Joel Embiid can be at the lottery, because next year it's going to be awkward if he's back. If we are back next year at the finals and Adam Silver is still saying, hey guys, it's going to work itself out, don't worry about it, I'm not sure he can play that card again, right? Like, I think he has it here in the short term. I don't think he needs to admit that his league is on the precipice of some disaster. I mean, I agree with what you're saying. There's not a crisis scenario here.
Yeah.
But it's not great.
Right.
You look at Lee Jenkins' story in terms of the GMs who are basically saying, like, we're just trying to play to be on the opposite side of the bracket. We're treating these teams almost like they're Kentucky in the NCAA tournament. You know, we're just hoping that we can sell our fans on a playoff series victory or two. That is totally true. We have been saying that about so many different teams. Like, just go up and down the Clippers, the Jazz, the Rockets, the Thunder. I mean, all those teams. I mean, the Celtics. I mean, all the cute stories in the Eastern Conference. The Celtics, the Raptors, you know, your Wizards. I mean, you were just praying to get to the Eastern Conference Finals. That was going to be a party for you, right? And so that isn't great, you know, when like your entire second tier is just kind of focused on the whole bronze medal talk, like I've kind of coined it. And then you've got another tier of teams, you know, probably 15 of them who just have no shot at all. I don't know. I mean, I think there is some long-term concerns there in terms of keeping fan bases engaged, I guess.
Yeah, well, and we shouldn't single out Silver too much. Like, I'm pro-Silver. I really like him. I just think that part of his job as commissioner is that sometimes he has to be kind of the bad guy. And he has not played that role thus far. And like, you can't always play to the internet. Like, sometimes you have to sort of like draw a line. And unfortunately, the only time he's done that is ignoring critics and moving the All-Star game back to Charlotte, which kind of sucks. And as far as the NBA issue, one last thing, it's inaccurate to say that the league is actually suffering from this. Like, I don't think they're going to become less popular. I think what's being left on the table is that is a lot of room for growth. And there is nobody really likes the NFL anymore, despite it clearly being the most popular sport in America. But like, there's room for this, for the NBA to really sort of take off over the next 5 or 6 years. And that's what maybe is being lost with some of these sort of like underwhelming series, is that I'm not sure how invested outsiders and casual fans are going to get.
Yeah. I mean, just for the numbers, 75 games so far in the playoffs, 46 of those 75 were double digit games. 20 of the 75 were 20 plus point wins.
Right.
Right.
And look, the ratings have been fine. The ratings really haven't suffered as much as you'd expect. I just wonder how much better the ratings might have been if these games actually mattered.
Hey, so here's my legitimate actual beef with Adam Silver, is not related to really any of this. Can I give it to you?
Uh-huh.
My problem with him is that, unlike a lot of these players who have just decided to own the podium and to come out swinging with talking points and like statements that they're really clearly, obviously trying to get out there.
Yep.
Silver just doesn't really do that. And that was always a staple of the David Stern press conference too. Like, he was going to have his target, whoever it might be, whatever issue it might be. And he was really going to put that out and feed the headlines, right?
Right.
Silver is just not really wired that way. Like you're saying, he's a nice guy. He kind of wants business to just go along, keep everybody happy, hunky-dory. You know, you look at his press conference last night, I mean, he didn't have an answer on the competitive balance issue. He really struggled with the issue he knew he was going to face, was that North Carolina one. You go up and down his other conversations, like the one and done thing was what he kind of brought out to discuss, hey, they need to change it. He didn't have a clear angle on how he wanted to change it. He just said everybody hates it and he left it there. And it's like, Adam, what are we supposed to write about this?
Well, and not only that, that to me was the worst look. And honestly, the only quote I saw was Adam Silver talking about how unhappy everyone is with the one and done rule after 2 months of just probably the worst playoffs of this millennium. And he wants us to focus on the one and done rule. It's like, come on, man. Like, first of all, most people are fine with a one and done rule. It's kind of a solution where everyone is a little bit unhappy but can accept it, which is how you know it's probably the right deal. And that's fine. Like, that's not the issue that the NBA should be worried about this month.
That's what I'm saying. And so that's your takeaway. It's like this lukewarm take on one and done. Like, if he had come out and said, hey, we have studied this issue for 3 years. Here's what I'm proposing. I want the players union to join in me with this. Let's do it. Now we've got a story. Now we can really discuss this thing. And he just doesn't do that. And this is not like a one-time thing from Silver, by the way. This has bothered me for a few years now. His lack of sort of decisive headline making. And, you know, just consider it constructive criticism, because I think he's doing overall, he's doing a phenomenal job.
Exactly. We're still pro Silver. Just a little constructive criticism. All right. We are at the hour mark. Let's do 10 more minutes of podium talk. Owen asks, which team do you think will be the most exciting to watch over the next couple of years? In other words, pick your bandwagon. I don't really have a favorite at the moment. Minnesota seems like the standout, with Philly and maybe the Bucks. What's your pet team?
I got really excited by Milwaukee's first round playoff series. I mean, those guys have been looming forever. I tend to hop on some of these bandwagons too early and some of these bandwagons too late. I'm probably on the Bucks bandwagon a little bit too late. But I would say watching Giannis kind of take this next leap, which I'm really anticipating here over the next couple of years, is for sure like very high on my list. The other one I would say, and I'm mainly saying this to kind of get a rise out of you, I'm pretty excited for the Ben Simmons era in Philly. I think he's, for obvious reasons, been completely slept on here for the last 18 months because he's just kind of been away from the game.
Yeah.
He's a special talent. He's one of those guys, the first time I saw him play in high school, was like, oh, wow, this kid could be really, really, really special player. And I'm ready to see that unfold, with or without Embiid, by the way.
Like, great.
I could take or leave Embiid.
Good luck with the Ben Simmons bandwagon. They can't draft 80% of the lottery this year because they don't fit with Ben Simmons. But sure, he's going to be great. My answer to this question, I think about this a lot. And I think the Bucks should be disqualified because they have been the internet's favorite team for probably 2 or 3 years in a row now. And at some point... It's just they're not allowed to be like league pass favorites. Minnesota, I want to be on the bandwagon, but really, like as has already been established, I came in this year with really high hopes, and then couldn't bring myself to watch more than like 5 to 10 Wolves games this year because they all ended in the most heartbreaking fashion possible, and it was actually pretty remarkable. How consistently they blew games in the final 6 minutes of the fourth quarter. So I'm sticking with two Pacific Division standouts.
Oh boy,
the Sacramento Kings. I'm nice. All in on the Kings and Scal and Buddy and whoever they draft. Obviously, it's draft dependent. But they could either go Fox or Lonzo, and I would be all in. I'm not sure how I feel about Dennis Smith, but he'd be fun too. And then the Phoenix Suns, if they get Josh Jackson, I will watch like 75% of Suns games next year.
Do you know the best thing about your answer here?
What?
Is that you said two Pacific Division teams. Obviously, everyone knew off the top you weren't going to say Golden State or the Clippers because they just didn't fit this question.
Uh-huh.
There was only three Pacific Division teams left. And the team that you didn't pick, which is also an up-and-coming team, which their fans are desperately hoping for better days, is the Lakers, and you left them out. They were the one team that you didn't pick. That says so much about the Lakers right there.
That's true.
They're third in terms of the bandwagon jumping teams in their own division.
I can't bring myself to get too invested in the Lakers right now. We'll check back in 2 years. Once Brandon Ingram weighs 200 pounds, I think that's when they'll turn the corner, but we're not there yet.
Well, that Kings pick is good though, because you're getting probably, you know, the next couple of years before Buddy's age-related decline, you're going to be able to enjoy that.
Well, I'm also a big fan of Willie Cauley-Stein.
Oh, for sure. And Scal. I mean, they have reasons to cheer. You're going to be in early on that one. I think you're in for some heartbreak next year, probably the year after that. I mean, it's going to take a while. That's a pretty long rebuilding process. Yeah. There were some Derrick Rose whispers at the stadium last night for Kings fans to start, you know, gnawing their fingernails about. Watch out for that.
Let me be very clear. If the Kings sign Derrick Rose, I am out. And we will go back and delete the last 2 minutes of this podcast.
Well, real quick on the Suns. Tell me more about what you want them to do for the draft. I feel like you are the only person who pretends to be a Suns fan still, and you know a lot about the draft. Like, what is your dream draft for them?
It would be like Josh Jackson could be just a perfect fit next to Devin Booker and Eric Bledsoe and Marquise Chris. I mean, the future at the five is pretty murky because a lot of it depends on Dragan Bender, who just wasn't really healthy this year. And when he was healthy, couldn't really get on the court. But then again, he's a 19-year-old. So who knows? But I just really like that lineup they have. And I think that they are ready to sort of take a step forward. It's like they weren't, I don't know what they won this year. It's probably like 20 games. They were closer to a low 30s level team than the 2020 win team they had this year. And so I think that there's more room for them to grow than people realize. Like next year, they could actually get fun if they can shore up the defense a little bit.
And if it's not Jackson, who else would you look at?
If it's not Jackson, that might mean that De'Aaron Fox is available, and I would take Fox and trade Bledsoe.
Nice. That's what I was hoping you'd get to. Yeah. I really want that Bledsoe trade. People probably already know that. All right, next question.
Next question. We had one more thing on the draft and the Sacramento Kings. I really liked this email from Finland, from Hannu Hakkinen, and he gave us a real in-depth history of Lauri Markkanen and Finnish pro basketball, and including we had really high hopes for Petteri Koponen when he was drafted 10 years ago, but he was stashed so well by Portland that we now have no hope of the 29-year-old point guard playing for Barcelona ever coming over to the NBA. The Murphy brothers play for the Finnish national team, so we do count them as Finns in a sense, but Eric's NBA career didn't pan out that great either. To put this in perspective, in 2016, NHL draft picks 2, 4, and 5 were all born in Finland, and the last Finnish-born player played in the NBA when they were 4 years old. So Lauri Markkanen is a big deal, and the second half of his email was all about hoping that Lauri Markkanen doesn't come to the Kings, and I just want to let Hannu know that The Kings are they've turned a corner here post Boogie, and they are going to be young and up and coming and fun. So it's all good if he does go to the Kings.
We're gonna really know that people are afraid of going to the Kings if guys start not going to Kentucky because of it. Like if you start having like your final two being Kentucky and whoever, and then you just decide, I'm not gonna go to Kentucky because this is a feeder system for Vivek's fetishes. I'm staying away. So I think to kind of ease Hanu's concerns, I mean, Markkanen didn't go to, he wasn't a Wildcat. You're fine. He's gonna miss the Russian roulette game here. He will not get drafted by Sacramento. Hey, real quick though, I remember the Petteri Koponen era. By the way, you nailed the pronunciation of his name. So first of all, Blazers fans have the Great White Hope thing. I mean, that's definitely a thing in Portland. The Great White Finnish Hope was for sure a thing because that was right in the peak of when they were kind of nailing draft picks and everybody had faith in the organization. So he was going to be like the point guard of the future, the X factor, kind of a similar to like a Rudy Fernandez and Sergio Rodriguez, like import who was going to be a game changer. Other teams weren't going to see him coming. I was getting emails for years after they drafted him about how this was the guy who was going to put the Portland over the top. Still hasn't played in the NBA as Hannu mentioned. So that's just kind of how it goes.
Well, him and Yaroslav Korolev, I definitely got that name wrong, but those were two early Euros that never really panned out because Korolev went to the Clippers, right? In the lottery.
Yeah, I think we should also throw Rodrigue Bubois into this conversation.
Roddy Buckets had his moments. All right, more than Koponen or Korolev, but
he had more moments in trade rumors in terms of being untouchable than he had on the court. I mean, I've never seen a player like that.
Yes.
Anyway, we're getting a little too deep into the Finnish basketball talk. But Hannu, We're excited for Lauri. We've been kind of making jokes about how he's not a Kobe Bryant player on past podcasts. We're going to retract those specifically for you. We are now looking forward to him playing for anybody besides Sacramento.
Yeah, and they started calling him Kyle as a nickname because his first name is Lowry, so they call him Kyle Lowry Markkanen, which is pretty fantastic.
Do you think that's really like a nationwide thing, or is that Hanu and his buddies?
I think it's Hanu and his buddies, but I hope it becomes a nationwide thing. All right, three more questions here, one of which is from me. Colin says, too sharp. Would you rather have the Wizards be playing in the current NBA Finals against these Warriors or get a guest spot on the rights to Ricky Sanchez? You don't listen to the rights to Ricky Sanchez, so you wouldn't realize that I have been banned from appearing on their podcast,
I'm wearing my blank Andrew Sharp t-shirt that they made. I bought it off eBay. It was $49.99, one of the best investments I ever made.
It's pretty upsetting. And honestly, it's strictly because one of the co-hosts there is not prepared to debate me in public. He's scared of he's scared of my truth. And it is what it is. He's scared of how real I'll keep it on the Sixers, and he doesn't want to face me. And it's fine.
He's terrified of the greased pig. He's not ready.
And we talked about, because the co-host is Mike Levin, and last time I was with him in LA, which was last week, we talked about this question, and I'm curious to get your take. Would you trade the third pick and Ben Simmons for Kristaps Porzingis?
No, I wouldn't.
Really?
I get where you're going with that. You know, we did talk about how I'd trade, you know, Fultz for Porzingis if you're a Boston. No, I don't know. I'm just not ready to cash in on Simmons. I know you definitely are, but to me, it's still hard to build a championship team around a big guy as your main guy, right? And if you're trading those two assets for Porzingis, you have to do it. They also have Embiid, so I don't know how that fit would work. And then it's kind of like the Cat scenario or the Anthony Davis scenario or any of these other high usage big guys. Like, can you build an elite offense around those guys as your main scorer? I'm still waiting for that to happen. You look at the best offenses right now in the league, and that's not really how they're structured. For that reason, I would rather roll the dice with Simmons. I think the third pick can be a really, really good player. I'd love to hear what you think they should do at three. But the combination of a potential franchise, you know, lead ball handler plus another really good player, to me, is the direction I would go.
Okay. I mean, that's perfectly fair. I just think that it's hard to imagine being committed to the process and then saying, nope, they have to stick here and take and make each one of these lottery picks. I think half the point of the process was to have so many different assets that you could just sort of swing for a superstar whenever they're available. And right now, like, the Sixers have the Lakers pick plus next year's pick coming, both of which will likely be in the lottery, and they get the Kings pick in 2 years. Like, they're going to have opportunities to find younger players. And if you could swing three and Simmons for Kristaps, I would do it. But and plus, there's also going to be guys like, I think we got an email about Bledsoe to Philly. Like, there are going to be options for them to fix that backcourt that will probably make more sense than some of these guards. So all I'm saying is that it's a question I would be into debating on the Ricky, but they won't have me. So it is what it is. And for the record, I'd much rather have the Wizards playing in these finals because it would be hilarious to watch them get blown off the court. And yeah, see how upset America would be.
Look, my only take is this. I'm pretty shameless in terms of asking for people to follow me on Instagram on this podcast. This was more shameless than that. I mean, you're just openly campaigning to have an invite to a podcast that easily could invite you on at any moment.
I want you to know.
Of just begging here.
The relationship is broken. I'm not appearing on the podcast. Even if they asked me at this point, I'm not appearing.
Wow.
But
you know who you sound like is Russell Westbrook. Why don't you cue up Sister Act 2?
Yeah, exactly. Casey says, since the playoffs have been sorely predictable and anticlimactic, let's throw down a bit. Honestly, who would win in a one-on-one basketball game between you two? I should have asked this earlier when you were both in California together. My money is on old man Golly, even with his bum knee.
Nice.
Can I be honest with you? I am not very good at basketball and am also, I just don't really play very often. And so I, and you're also 6'5", which most people don't realize. But I think after watching you wobble around in person, I really do think that I could take you.
Get out of here, wobble around.
I don't know, man. I think I could take you. Get you out on the perimeter, make you move around a little bit.
The thing is, are we going to have a ref calling the 5-second back down rule? Like, can I just Charles Barkley you? Because I think if I could do that, there's not really a chance. I also think, I mean, if I knew I had to beat you one-on-one and I had a month to kind of get my game sharp, I don't think there's a chance. I think I would take you.
Yeah, maybe we can settle it at Summer League. All right, the final email, which you have been looking forward to for a while. Do you want to read it?
Actually, I think it's going to work better if you read it, but let me just set this up by saying Stavros, I believe he's Australian. Yes, Australian musician. He sent us some real epic emails. I mean, the 1,000-word varieties. He's got YouTube links that he's requested that we check out. I mean, this is an all-in podcast listener, so we appreciate that. His email pertains to a question I had asked you, which was basically, would you ever travel thousands of miles like Argentinians fans did for Manu Ginobili throughout his career? And you countered with that you went to Boston for Game 7, right? This is the background for Stavros's 5,000-word epic email.
Yes. All right. So I'll just, it's a paragraph here. Stavros says, Sharp just likened Argentinian fans' pilgrimage to San Antonio to witness potentially Manu's final game to his 90-minute flight to Boston to watch Brandon Jennings. Sharp, sure you're married, but you don't have kids, so you're not truly past it. How the hell can you say maybe you would go to the Olympics? I live in Sydney, and the Olympics came to my town when I was 20 years old, and it was unbelievable. I traveled thousands of miles or kilometers. Yes, Andrew, that's a unit of measurement. And yes, where I'm from, I spelled that term correctly. And I spent thousands of dollars to watch the Spurs Big Three a few years ago. Cause, well, why the fuck not? Seriously, man, you only live once. You're relatively wealthy. Presumptuous of me, but you do live in the USA, so the adverb relatively is important there. And you can't even say, I'd go to a foreign country to watch a World Cup, a UEFA final, an Olympic event, etc. Which brings me to my questions. Is Sharp secretly just some total trailer park trash yokel posing as a writer? And does he even have a passport?
Wow.
Yeah. I don't know, man.
Flames. I love this. Well, first of all,
he really brought the heat.
He did. Let's take these questions one at a time, though. Sometimes, these two-part questions are a big problem in the finals. These guys try to sneak them in and the players kind of blanch. And I can feel you doing the same thing. First question first. Are you just some total trailer park trash yokel posing as a writer?
No. Well, sometimes, yes. But look, I take issue with a couple different premises of this question. First of all, the Olympics came to him. The Olympics came to Stav in Sydney. All right. He didn't travel to the Olympics. Also, I went to the Olympics last year. And honestly, one takeaway was that I would never do that if I did not have a press pass, because it's crowded, it's hard to get around, and it's really expensive. So that's number one. Number two, if I'm going to another country, I'd rather go to a country to see something other than sports, because we have enough cool sports in America.
Oh, sorry, wow. You're playing the elitist card. The elitist card is coming out.
Sorry, I can see a lot of cool sports in DC or in Boston, like Game 7. Like, there's plenty of options here. If I'm going to Europe, I want to go and do other cool shit that I can't do in America.
Wow, you really flipped that from trailer park trash yokel to like one percenter sports fan.
Yeah, well, it is what it is. Sorry, man. And do I have a passport? Yes, I have a passport. But I really did. I appreciated the passion of this email because he also embedded some clips from his music career in Sydney. I think he's a radio host over there. And yeah, like, Stav, keep doing your thing. Keep sending us questions. But the Olympics, honestly, I'm not sure how cool it is as sort of like a destination sporting event.
Well, one thing I'd say, the only thing I've really done along these lines, I went to the World Cup in Germany with my younger brothers, and we saw Germany win in Berlin Stadium. I believe they beat Argentina in the quarterfinals. It was one of the most memorable and goosebump-inducing sporting events I've ever been to. So I think I actually would travel for the right sporting event. But I do hear what you're saying. You got to kind of pick and choose, because the Olympics, from what you described, kind of sounded like Disneyland, and that's not really my scene, you know, like sports Disneyland. It's just too much. But coming out of that World Cup game after they won, I feared for my life. I mean, the celebrations were so over the top. People were like standing on top of cars as they were moving. Other people were like throwing beer bottles off of like third story balconies onto the street. I was pretty sure that if I didn't get killed by the mob, my parents were going to kill me for losing one of my younger brothers like in the mob. So that is something you have to factor in, I think, to this equation too, is like, it's not quite the same thing to travel all the way across the world to go see the Spurs win by 30 points over like the Charlotte Bobcats or Hornets or whatever, as it is to like go to some of these countries where the passion is on a different level and sometimes borders in, you know, hooliganism or whatever you want to call it.
That's true. I mean, one of the things on my bucket list, I really want to see like a big English Premier League game. But I'm also not going to schedule an entire trip around making that happen. The World Cup one is a good exception though, because it's also like there's only one stadium that you need to get to. The Olympics, one of the issues with the Olympics is you're trying to like crisscross around town and see a bunch of different things and get tickets to a bunch of different things. It can be tough. So, but if it's just one game, particularly like in the later rounds, like you have a couple big games in the tournament play, that would be awesome. But you know, I'm going on my honeymoon later this summer, and there's going to be no sports, and it'll be awesome.
You guys are going to go to like the rugby sevens?
I don't think so. I think that would be cause for a divorce.
Didn't your wife say she wanted to go see India, Pakistan, and cricket?
No, she actually said let's just go to Vegas for summer league. I just need more hoops in my life.
Oh my God. Yeah. Awesome. You found the one.
Exactly. All right, man. Well, it's time to wrap this up. Enjoy your time in the Bay. Good luck at that event on Saturday with the Warriors World people. I can't wait to hear about it. And we will talk next Monday, probably after game two.
No doubt. 5-star reviews on iTunes. Email the rights to Ricky Sanchez, people. Let's end this war. Let's bring these two sides together. We have too much hate in our world. Guys, you know I love the parks. This whole Paris thing has got me bummed out. Go outside this weekend, take in some oxygen and some trees. Appreciate the world that we've got. Openfloormail@gmail.com for all of your questions. Andrew, I'll talk to you next week.
Great sign off, man. Talk to you soon.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.